To remind you, we're in the midst of a six-week series on addictions. That's all in the past. Someone brought to my attention that in our material on AA, it was a lot of history, and it was. I didn't really say much about current AA. All I wish to say at this time is it's international. Millions of people access it, and it is one of the resources available. Now, today we're going to look at treatment principles with an emphasis on opioids and alcohol. I wanted to get into some other drugs, but quite frankly, we simply don't have time. Now, in week six, that's kind of a free-for-all week. If you want to ask questions about particular drugs or other things, you can do it then. Next time, not next week, because we're off next week, you know, for Promotion Sunday, but next time we meet, we'll talk about process addictions with the emphasis on sexual addiction. And then our final week, like I say, that's kind of our free-for-all. So bring your questions. Today's material will mostly be scientific. We're going to be running the gamut from neuroanatomy to genetics to pharmacology. Don't worry, we're not going too deep. This is skimming the surface. And if I ask questions, none of the healthcare professionals in the audience, if there are any, are entitled to answer those questions. So although the material today is scientific, let's not lose sight of the spiritual material, so to speak. And let's remind ourselves that there but for the grace of God go I. And although I will be speaking about addiction principles, keep in mind every addict has a unique life story. And if you listen carefully, you'll begin to understand the origins and animations, that is what drives it. And last week we heard Susan's story. And today we will hear Steve's story. And like Susan, Steve is an accomplished speaker. He's on the speaker's circuit. No, actually, they're very frightened to come up in front of you. But as they learn in AA, if you're given an opportunity to share your story and help others, you do it. Okay, pretest, but there won't be any grades. The majority of individuals who are treated with narcotics, that is opioids, for chronic pain become addicted, true or false?
False.
Fortunately. Alcoholism is an inevitably progressive disease, true or false? Well, we used to think true, but it's actually false. Not as many takers on that last one. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, abbreviated CDC, amphetamine abuse is the fastest growing drug problem in the U.S., true or false?
True.
False. And the true answer will follow. Now, I want to begin with some deconstruction of misconceptions, mythology, if you will. There's a big misunderstanding about the distinction between dependence and addiction, and there is a distinction, and even healthcare professionals don't get it most of the time. First, physical dependence. What is it? Well, when the body is exposed to a substance repeatedly, the body adapts. And when that drug is suddenly removed, or if it's tapered down too rapidly, what results is known as a withdrawal syndrome, and that's different. It looks different depending upon what drug is involved. I know this happened with my own son, who was treated for cancer, and he was on high-dose opioids because of the cancer effects. He's sent home with, you know, a short script of a narcotic, and he goes into withdrawal. Well, was he addicted? No, but he had become physically dependent, and in very quick fashion. And then there's the idea of tolerance, which is over time, and that could be usually months, even years, an increased amount of the substance is needed in order to get the same effect. So if you're treating someone for pain, for example, you may have to, over time, increase the dose of the opioid. Now, this can look like addiction, but there's a thing called pseudo-addiction. I didn't put that on here, but it's an important concept, too. If an individual is inadequately treated for pain, suboptimally treated, you might say, they may ask for more of the drug. It may seem like they are drug-seeking, but in fact, they're just looking for better relief. That's called pseudo-addiction. Now, what is addiction proper? Well, here's a definition from Washington State Department of Health, and this kind of echoes the prevailing scientific definition from the national societies. You'll notice this doesn't reflect the spiritual material that we've covered previously, but this is the working diagnosis. Addiction is a primary, meaning not secondary to something else, chronic, long-lasting, neurobiological disease with genetic, psychosocial, and environmental factors influencing its development and manifestations. What does it look like? Well, it's characterized by behaviors that all begin with a C. First, impaired control, there's the C, over drug use. And so they may have first been exposed to an opioid, say, after a surgery, but then over time they find that, gee, this helps with all kinds of things, or so they think, and they spiral out of control in their use of the drug and can't stick to the prescribed schedule. Compulsive use speaks for itself. Cravings, these are very strong desires for a substance. And today we'll restrict our comments to substances. Next time we'll talk about the process, addictions. And then there's continued use despite adverse consequences. That's the C there. Okay, a little of the science for starters. That's a brain. It's kind of dark. But we have, this is showing the so-called reward pathway, one of the reward pathways. And it involves the VTA, ventral tegmentum area, deep in the brain here, which is in communication with the nucleus accumbens, and then in communication with prefrontal cortex. Dopamine, we see, is the primary neurotransmitter in reward pathways. So your highly addictive substances, they all have a strong effect on the production or the way dopamine is used by the brain. Now, this VTA, so-called, again, I'm giving you the flyby. This is not in-depth. We don't have time for that. But what the main gist here is that the VTA analyzes information from other areas of the brain and body about what we would call needs and signals the nucleus accumbens accordingly. And then in the nucleus accumbens, abbreviated NA, that's where the pleasurable sensation is reinforced. So when they do studies on rats, you know, and they have them press the lever and all, they've done studies where they can go directly to the nucleus accumbens with a probe and stimulate that, and a rat will literally pursue a chemical, cocaine or whatever, to its death, because it will perceive that need as being greater than even the need for sleep, food, whatever, other survival needs. I mean, that's how strong this. If you challenge this pathway enough, how strong the drive can be. And then the prefrontal cortex up here, you might think of that as the brakes, okay? And this explains why teenagers are so vulnerable to addictions, because that area of the brain is underdeveloped, not yet fully developed in teenagers, even into early adulthood. And so they have difficulty putting on the brakes. Okay, on to substance use disorders, generally speaking, SUD. Now, everything today, you know, is spoken of as a disorder. I don't know if you like the terminology, but again, I'm giving you the prevailing terminology, scientific terminology. First, some basic treatment principles, and at the end, I'll give you a link, a web link you can go to if you like. By the way, you can ask me for these slide sets after the fact, and I'll send them via email. First principle, different substances have different addiction potential. It's impossible to accurately predict who will become addicted, but there are at-risk populations. We've already said teens, and that's true for most drugs. But each particular drug has an at-risk subset of folks. And treatment, one size does not fit all. So if you have someone who is dedicated to, say, for example, AA, and I'm not knocking AA. I mean, we gave a whole week to it almost last week, so there is value to it. But if they make you believe that, you know, the only way to get past your or deal with your alcoholism is to attend AA. That's not exactly a truism. And I can say that because, and this is a fact, like it or not, majority of alcoholics never seek treatment, and many of them give up drinking without formal treatment. I think the reason for this primarily is because we now know that alcoholism is mostly episodic. Now, an episode can last years. And about 75% of alcoholics, they only have a single episode, and that's earlier in life, usually in the 20s. Probably college years. So I know when I entered college, the drinking age was 18. Not a good idea. So when they raised the drinking age to 21, that was a proper thing to do, because you don't want to give college age kids free access to alcohol. Detox. You all know what detox is. When you usually done in an inpatient hospital, but it could be done outpatient, but it's medically supervised. This is when you rapidly get them off the substance. I think detox is overrated myself, and I can say that because I don't work in a detox center, but it really is only the first stage of treatment, and by itself, it does little to change the course of drug addiction. This is like, the analogy would be a diabetic who has diabetic ketoacidosis. They're hospitalized, stabilized, and then they go home to manage their diabetes, or not manage their diabetes. If they don't manage it well, they end up back in the hospital with another complication. Same thing with the addict who goes through detox. Unless they get into long-term treatment and figure things out, they're just going to be back to square one. Other principles, you always need to think about comorbid psychiatric conditions, things like depression, ADHD, the list goes on and on. Certain conditions, I mentioned ADHD for one, have a strong correlation with substance abuse disorders. It's up to 40-45%. Now, depression is much more common, so even though the association is not as strong with depression, we have more depressive folks in our population, so potentially more addicts there. Relapse is more the rule than the exception. Again, going back to the diabetic analogy, if the diabetic forgets to take or chooses not to take insulin, if they're insulin dependent and suffer the consequences, that would be considered a relapse. They have stepped outside of the treatment plan. You know, we don't chastise the diabetic. Well, maybe we do, but, you know, you work with them and you get them back on track. And that's the link. It's National Institutes for Drug Abuse. It's a good reference. Okay, now on to research. Very interesting stuff going on in the field of research and addictions. Most of this is government funded. This is one of the few areas where I think government dollars are a good thing. Government spending, I should say. Because if you took the government out of the mix, there would be very little research in this area. So what are some of the foci of research? Well, first of all, genetics and proteins. Let me get up to speed here with my own notes. Oh, before we I forgot one thing back here. I didn't mention this, but one important principle is this. Treatment need not be voluntary in order to be effective. And what I had in mind here is interventions. You've all heard of that concept, okay? And I think there's even a TV show, Intervention. I've never watched it, but my patients tell me about it. And if you're looking for a good book for dad, for your father or spouse, husband, on Father's Day, a good one is Pat Summerall's autobiography, On and Off the Air. Now, any of you my generation, you know the name Pat Summerall. You grew up listening to Pat Summerall. He was the CBS commentator for 30, 32 years, former NFL football player himself. Well, in 1992, Pat was summoned to a meeting. He thought it was just a business meeting. NFL execs were there, CBS execs, and unbeknownst to him, family members. He arrives at this hotel room, and they do an intervention. And Pat's not pleased about it. And they send him off to the Betty Ford Institute, or whatever it's called, down in Rancho Mirage, California. Now, you remember Betty Ford. She herself had been intervened on about a year after her husband left the White House. And she later described that experience as, she referred to her family members at her intervention as a bunch of monsters. So, trust me, people are usually not happy to be intervened on, but the outcome can be very favorable, and in the case of Betty Ford, it was. And just incidentally, she, after President Ford and after the Fords left Washington, D.C. at the end of his presidency, they settled, they lived in Rancho Mirage, and one of their neighbors was Leonard Firestone. Now, for those of you that were here last week, you'll recall the name Firestone. That was one of the tire magnates from Akron, Ohio. Well, one of the sons of that Firestone that I mentioned last week was the next-door neighbor to Betty Ford. So interesting how these things come around. And I don't think Leonard himself had a drinking problem, but some in his family had, as we learned last week. So together they formed what became the Betty Ford Center. I forget the official name of her center, but I don't think initially it was called name for her, but they asked her after the fact if she'd be willing to have her name put on the center, and she somewhat reluctantly agreed to. But anyway, Pat Summerall, it's an excellent book, and in recalling his treatment there at the Betty Ford Center, he said there, i.e. at the center, the normal stay is 28 days. They kept me 33 days because they said, you were so angry for the first 5 days that they didn't count. And so that's why I say people aren't usually overjoyed when they get intervened on. But I don't know if you know this story of Pat Summerall. If not, you got to get his book and read it. But the skinny of it is he started reading the Bible, which was kind of like at hotels. You know, they have the Gideon Bible there. He started reading the Bible, and he got saved there at the Betty Ford Center. And even though I'm sure their emphasis was not Christian, but they do allow, you know, for spiritual things at those treatment centers. So a very convincing, strong testimony of conversion. And in an interview, if you just email me and I can get you the reference, I came across this on the web, Pat Summerall, Gridiron, God, and Graham. And in there he tells the story, and he tells when he spoke at a Billy Graham crusade and he got to meet Billy Graham. And Billy, when they meet, Billy says, oh, Pat, I've been wanting to meet you for so long, but I never thought I would. And Pat says, that's exactly what I was going to say to you. Stole his line. Okay, enough for the Betty Ford and Pat Summerall. Back to research now. Genetics and proteins. You know, genes, which are genetic material, code for proteins. If I was going to be a scientist, I would study proteins. They are cool things. Do a lot. Now, here's some old data from the alcohol research. You need to know a little about metabolism. Alcohol gets acted on by an enzyme. If you see ASE in a word, that means enzyme, okay? It kind of catalyzes the process, moves it along. So you have alcohol. It gets acted on by alcohol dehydrogenase to produce a chemical called acetaldehyde. The body doesn't like acetaldehyde. I mean, it just doesn't sound like a good thing, so not surprising the body doesn't like it. That's primarily responsible for the hangover, okay? Disulfiram, for example, you've heard of that drug, Anabuse. I'm getting ahead of the story. So how do we get rid of the acetaldehyde? With this guy, acetaldehyde dehydrogenase, yet another enzyme which converts this, the intermediate, into acetic acid, which is basically vinegar. So when you drink alcohol, you're creating vinegar. That's a good reason not to drink right there. But anyway, so we know this pathway, and therapeutically we've been able to do something with it with Anabuse. Although Anabuse is an older drug, it has problems with liver damage. So, you know, it's really not our go-to drug today. Now, on to some new data. Nicotine, this is new as of, it was just published in the American Psychiatric Association Journal last month. They have located a cluster, actually three to be exact, receptor genes. And let me just quickly read, make sure we're doing okay on time here. Okay. Here's the conclusion to this study. Very interesting. So if you're a smoker and maybe you've tried smoking cessation aids and it didn't work, why is that? Well, this may provide the clue. Conclusion, smokers with the high-risk haplotype, that is these three genes, or alleles, actually, which are parts of genes, or parts of chromosomes, the high-risk haplotype were three times as likely to respond to pharmacologic cessation efforts, you know, things like Chantix, as were smokers with the low-risk haplotype. The high-risk haplotype increased the risk of cessation failure, and this increased risk was ameliorated, that is made better, by cessation pharmacotherapy. So you see what they're getting at is we can, in the near future, we should be able to identify who are the high-risk smokers. In other words, who has this haplotype? They are the ones that would most benefit from our interventions. The rest of you can probably just figure it out and quit on your own without too much effort. By identifying a high-risk genetic group with heightened response to smoking cessation pharmacotherapy, this work may support the development of personalized cessation treatments. Very important. Because right now, our treatments are basically like chemotherapy. It's shotgun, okay? But even chemotherapy is getting better now because we're getting into immunotherapy where, you know, you can identify where the problem is. Let's target that. So we're finally beginning to get a little better. And then another interesting piece of, this is recent, cocaine. This gets kind of techie, but again, they're looking at an enzyme that breaks down cocaine. So if we can speed that process up, even if a person is using, it's not going to have the same effects. So that's what they're looking at. And they're also looking at the vaccine for cocaine, because, quite frankly, up to this point, we've had very little to offer cocaine addicts in the way of treatment. So the goal of all of this research from a therapeutic standpoint is to better predict those who are at risk, or the high risk, really, and target prevention and treatment accordingly. This is just the study published on the NIDA site. I would encourage you to go online. There's a lot of information on these government sites, and here's another one, NIAAA, National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. By the way, they have published this little booklet. It's about 12 pages or so. You can go online and request it for free. I have about 100 of those in my office that I give out liberally. This is an excellent thing to give to friends, family members, acquaintances that you know or suspect have a drinking problem. It's not judgmental, but it's very factual. It talks about, you know, what is a standard drink, how much is too much. And they don't take the line that, you know, a drink, you know, even up to a couple drinks may be problematic. So a couple facts now about alcohol. The average age of onset is 20. That probably overlaps with the college scene. Average age of first treatment is 30. So there is a lapse or a gap there from the time they engage in treatment. Those that do, we've already said that the majority never seek treatment, and majority actually don't need it. Natural course, that is what to expect over time. Well, it's very heterogeneous because there are what we call multiple life trajectories. And going back to our pre-test quiz question, this is not an inevitably progressive disease. And that's somewhat counterintuitive, because it's definitely counter to what we've been taught for years. But the latest research does not support that it is inevitably progressive. About a quarter of those with alcohol use disorders who recover ever receive professional treatment or AA exposure. Now, by the way, this is broadly defined. That could be even a visit to the minister, okay? There are those whom we would call treatment seekers versus natural remitters. The natural remitters, those that quit, have less severe dependence. So on average, they have lower blood alcohol levels, if you're talking about alcoholism, less physical, psychological comorbidity, better social function and resources. This is considered in a phrase called social capital. And what are some available treatments for alcohol use disorders? Well, psychosocial support, and that's a big canopy, including all kinds of counseling, psychotherapy, et cetera, and AA, which we've had an introduction to last time. And then drugs or pharmacological therapy. Up to this point in time, there's been a paucity of safe and efficacious treatments. And I suppose that's just a function of the amount of research that's been done. I don't know. But the new kid on the block is this one, Vivitrol, which reduces cravings and shows promise in ongoing, both completed and ongoing research studies. Now, let's leave alcohol and talk about narcotics briefly. Our word narcotic is from the Greek word meaning numb. These are opium-like compounds derived from the opium plant with analgesic or pain-relieving properties. Now, law enforcement started using this term many decades ago. It's somewhat regrettable because their use of the term is very nonspecific. They would, you know, anything that was illicit was a narcotic as far as the cops were concerned, and I think they still speak that way. But when lay folks use the term narcotic, you all are smarter than cops. You know that these things, narcotics, are really just the pain relievers, not everything else. But may I suggest an even better term is the medical term opioids, okay? Or opiate, if you wish. We don't have time to go into the distinction between those two. Now, interesting trend here, disturbing trend, actually. Prescribing practices changed in the early to mid-1990s. What happened? There was an increased emphasis on undertreated chronic pain. That in and of itself was not a bad thing. If there truly are folks that are being undertreated, well, that needs to be addressed. And it was. How was it addressed? Well, there was an increase in prescriptions for opioids. So the drug companies talk to the doctors and say, doctor, look at these new drugs we have, and look at your patients who are suffering. Write those prescriptions. And the prescriptions flowed. Unintentional consequence, overdose deaths. Oops. Maybe we need to look at this more closely. Now, here's the answer to that third test question, pretest question. Prescription drug abuse. Prescription drug abuse. Fastest growing drug problem in the U.S. And it's related to the fact that there are more prescriptions, obviously. So this is per 100,000. These are United States statistics from the CDC. Now notice here, this is, if you can't see it in the back, this is 1970, this is 1990. So during those two decades, things were pretty flat. Most of these deaths, I believe, were heroin related. Some were prescription products, but mostly heroin. Heroin, if you follow it out, if you broke this down by drug, heroin would be low level, and it just continues, you know, out here. It the rate of heroin deaths hasn't increased. Yes?
Is this possibly an off-schedule use for terminating a miserable end-of-life experience?
No. No, this is not. No. I mean, maybe a very small blip on the screen, but that really isn't what's going on. But as of, notice here, 1990, that's when we see this big rise. What's happening? Well, I just told you what's happening. It was the prescribing practices. Now, another thing you should know about these opioids, they come in schedules, okay? The DEA defined this back in the 70s, five schedules, and other things, not just opioids, are scheduled, you know, your stimulants and a whole bunch of things. Schedule 1 are drugs that have high potential for abuse, serve no legitimate medical purpose. An example would be heroin. Schedule 2, high abuse potential with medical use. Examples, morphine, hydromorphone. Anybody know the brand name of hydromorphone? Dilaudid. Okay. If anybody knew that, I was going to say, you need to get into treatment. My wife, who's a nurse at a local hospital, she had a patient who knew the schedules. She didn't even know what schedules were. I guess they don't teach you that in nursing school, but this patient knew all the details. And then schedule 3, relatively less abuse potential, but trust me, you can easily get addicted to a schedule 3 drug. Hydrocodone, that's the Vicodin, whoever said Vicodin. Codeine, buprenorphine, we'll have a little more to say about that. Yeah. Right.
And it sort of made you relax, but it was hard for me to imagine anybody desperate to get more of that drug.
Right. And even though, thanks Rob, this is really the gateway for a lot of opioid addicts. They're treated postoperatively. And it's usually not the first exposure, because most folks, the first exposure, have just the same experience that you had. It may make you a little sedated, may make you constipated, help relieve your pain a bit, but that's about it. But we don't understand why this is, but certain individuals, I suspect it have something to do with brain chemistry. These drugs act differently in their system, and it's not always the first exposure, but on repeat exposures, something triggers, and for them, they definitely get the high. I'm going to blow by this. We're running out of time. There are the treatment paradigms that have kind of clashed. You can read this online if you wish. Basically, there are three states. There's a normal drug-free state, and then the euphoria. Now, this is a good segue to this. For those that do get the high, and not everybody does, okay, the majority do not get the high from the opioids at least, but if you are one of those that for whatever reason, and we don't understand it well, gets the high, it's often related to the potency of the drug and the route of administration. So, you know, if you get something IV, it's in your system a lot quicker. And then there's withdrawal. So if we're tracing this out, and I have a graph I give my patients, and it's, you know, imagine these ups and downs when you're going through your series of highs. But over time, tolerance develops. We already looked at what that is. And so now the excursions are the other way. They're below the line. They're withdrawal excursions, which are uncomfortable, and you'll do anything to, you know, to get out of withdrawal. And if you, because of tolerance, if you attempt to take a higher dose to get back to the high, you risk an overdose death. And we see this in folks that are sent home from, get out of prison, say after 6 months of non-use, although, as we know, there's a lot of drugs in prison. But work with me here. For the sake of illustration, they don't have exposure in prison. They get out. They go back to the same amount of drug they were taking before. They can die of an overdose death because their tolerance has gone down. I promised our speaker he'd come up at 10:25, so we're going to have to breeze through this. There are basically three drugs that have been approved for opioid treatment. And I'm going to show you these in historical order. Methadone. We don't have time to go over the difference between agonist and antagonist, et cetera. You know, after war, you have these epidemics of opioid problems. You can understand what that's all about. In Vietnam, it was extra bad because they had exposure to the opium dens there, not just, you know, being treated for their war injuries. The methadone clinics that still exist, they were created by legislation in the early 70s. The average dose of methadone in one of those clinics, 80 to 120 milligrams per day. Maintenance, that's high. Compare that to pain. Methadone can be used for chronic pain management, but that's usually in the order of, you know, 10 to 40 milligrams. The niche market for methadone in these clinics is heroin addicts. It's not suitable, in my opinion, for those addicted to other opioids and with a goal of being opioid-free. Next in order, this was in 1990, buprenorphine, which comes in two forms, Suboxone and Subutex. Again, we don't have time to go over the difference there. That's the legislation that allowed for in-office treatment. This was a big advancement because folks now don't have to queue up with heroin addicts if they want treatment for their opioid addiction. They can come to their doctor's office. However, their doctor has to be considered a WAVE physician, which means there's a little extra training required. And I say little because it's really not that much. But doctors aren't beating down the doors to become prescribers for Suboxone. Yeah, and if you want to find them, just go on Suboxone.com, Physician Finder, and you know, within a radius you can find them. But yes, I am one of them. Comes in two forms. Film is barcoded, so that potentially if someone finds it on the street, they could trace it back to the individual. This is a diversion control measure. Primary benefit of this drug, it decreases cravings and produces little to no euphoria, so it doesn't have the reinforcing effect. Warnings, the individual needs to know this is still an opioid. You're not opioid-free. But it has benefits over as a replacement product. It has benefits over other opioids, and there is a withdrawal syndrome post-treatment. They need to be prepared for that. And then finally, Vivitrol. We saw that was used for alcohol. That was approved in 1994. Within the last 2 years, it's been approved for opioid addiction. Again, it's affecting that pleasure pathway. It's not opioid replacement therapy, unlike methadone and Suboxone, but it is rather a true opioid blockade. It's an antagonist. Blocks the receptor. It's injectable every 4 weeks in the office. DEA, Drug Enforcement Agency, is not involved since it's not a controlled substance. And there is no withdrawal on completion of treatment. So I'm encouraging a lot of my patients to get switched over to this. It's got a lot of good. One big caveat, though, if you have trauma, oops, you got an opioid blockade, you know, long-term in your system, there are ways to get around that, but it's not easy. And if the individual has chronic pain issues, may need an opioid, this is not a good choice. And now we're going to have a personal testimony from an acquaintance of mine, Steve, followed by question and answers. Just a reminder, if you want slides, there's my email. We're off next week. Okay, Steve.
Hook this on my belt. Put that on the belt.
Steve's part of a speaker's bureau. He does this all the time.
So is it on? Is it working?
You're on.
Okay. Can I move some of your stuff?
Yours is under there.
Yeah. Well, hi, everybody. I'm Steve, and I'm here today by the grace of God. I used to refer to myself as an alcoholic addict. That was years ago. Since then, I've come to find that I don't like to identify myself by my disease. Very few people with diseases do that. And so at some point, I started out in AA. And at some point, I just quit saying it. I did at first, because when you first get in there, well, You got to fit in. You got to be an alcoholic. And so far, what I like to call is I've been addiction-free. And I've been that way for about 18 out of the last 23 years. So I was at about 15 years the first time, and it's been just a little over 3 now. When I started, I was about 17. Mainly that was just, you know, smoking pot, drinking beer, having some fun, things like that. But in the next 4 years, I ended up thinking, well, somebody would come up with something else. Like, well, yeah, I'll try that. Well, I'll try that. And I found I was pretty much willing to try anything. I didn't realize what was happening. To me, it was all in fun and games. It was just a big party. And it got to the point that I was just, it got to the point to where I couldn't quit doing it. And I didn't know why. I mean, every time I went out, you know, I'd have a certain intention, and that intention was never met. I was just going to go out and have, you know, a couple beers with the guys. Well, we have our beers. They go home. I decide to stay. And the next thing you know, I've called somebody, got some Coke, you know, and here it is 6 o'clock in the morning, and I have to go to work. You know, and I'm like, what is going on? And this was at a pretty early age. I went to my first AA meeting in 1984. I graduated high school in 79. I was only 23 years old and realizing that something's not right. But mainly I did it just to get, you know, my parents were involved. And so I thought, well, I'll go to a meeting, you know, and you know, try to do something. They'll get them off my back. You know, they'll leave me alone. I had no intention, you know, of doing it. In fact, I thought it was stupid. I'm sitting there listening to people. It's like, God dang, what a bunch of whiners, you know. It's like, gee, God, this guy's over here almost crying. Are you kidding me? Really? I'm not going to do that. Well, it wasn't much longer after that. I went to treatment for the first time in 1986. And actually, that's where I got my book. I still have it. It's gotten drenched in water. It's all beat to heck. But I still have it. And again, that was because my way of dealing with things was, you know, I would start to drink, but I knew how to get where I wanted to be a lot quicker. And that was to get on the phone and call up, you know, whomever, and get some cocaine. That was my thing back then. So, boom, because I wanted to be able to go as long as possible and just be obliterated. I did not want to think about what was going on. I went and did that one time, disappeared with my dad's truck for a week. I'd just gotten a big check from L&I, and I went and blew the whole thing. So now I'm in a position of, okay, how am I going to get around this? So I just said, I'll go to treatment. You know, and back then, I lived in Yakima. Getting into treatment was really pretty easy. They had the ADOTSA program. You go down there, you talk to a counselor, you tell them your thing, they pay for the whole deal. So a 30-day inpatient treatment. I came out, lasted about 3 months, and was drinking again. The second time I went to treatment was 1989. And in those 3 years, my life got so incredibly horrible that it's hard to describe. I know sometimes it seems as though you know, the person that's out there, you know, the alcoholic, the addict, they seem like that maybe they're having a good time. We're not. We're not. So, anyway, I got to a point to where I was done. I went back to 86. That one worked. I'd made it. And about a year later, I couldn't take it anymore. I'd tried to do these steps. I'd tried to do everything. And I walked out of a meeting for the first time ever. And a guy follows me out. And he says, you know, Steve, I know what you want. And I'm thinking, ah, great, one more person that's just going to tell me what I need. He says, you know, all you want is the ability to be happy. And, you know, yeah, he's right. And so I sat down with him, and he helped me go through some principles, some that were in this book that, you know, I was going to, you know, read some deals on that it talked to me, because I didn't know what it meant to be an alcoholic. You know, in the book, in the doctor's opinion, they talk about an allergy, you know, that we have an allergy to alcohol. And the thing that got me is it explained many things that I couldn't explain. It explained why when I went out to have, just go out, have a beer, and then, you know, be to work the next day, that didn't happen. And I found out that it was something up here. And it wasn't, you know, strictly just a moral issue, even though I felt pretty bad about the things I was doing. The biggest stumbling block I had, and I didn't even know it, because I'd come from a Christian background. You know, I was Sunday school. I loved Sunday school. You know, I had a deal where I was one of those that couldn't, I was afraid of the dark as a little kid. And try as my parents might, they just couldn't change it. And so one day I found a picture, had an angel on it. I traced it, cut it out, wrote on there, I love God, and I pinned it up over my bed. And that's how I was able to sleep at night. And went from that to becoming just this, you know, roaring, crazy drunk. Just tearing up my family. The thing that I found is this guy asked me, he says, you know, at some point now, you know, you figured out the physical aspect. Okay, but there's a reason why you're drink, you know, if you don't ever pick any of that stuff up, you're not going to kick that physical aspect in. So it came down to this is a spiritual condition. And so we had to talk about God. And he asked me, well, what is your concept of God? You know, and for the first time, you know, I tried to think back. And I said, you know, I don't know. I don't know what God is. And he asked, well, what do you think about God? And where it came from, but I blurted it out. I said, if there is a God, I hate his guts. I don't want anything to do with him. And this kind of went over a period of a few days, but I'd said things and blurted stuff out and just coughed up all this stuff that I would have never, ever, ever believed was even there, let alone confess to. To kind of wrap things up, and then I've got a little poem. That did it. I basically recovered from that point. I was now what I like to call disease or addiction free. And over the next 6 or 7 years, I worked with a lot of alcoholics. I had moved. I'd gone to a number of different churches, you know, gotten involved. And we went to a men's retreat. It's a big men's retreat. And for the first time, I actually heard on the screen with 200 guys something verifying what I had gone through with my thing with God. And I'm going to put my glasses on. I'll read this real quick and we'll wrap it up.
Sorry, I forgot to make the slide.
That's okay. Anyhow, this guy gets up in front of all of us and he reads this poem and I just about fell out of my chair. It says, I told God I was angry. I thought he'd be surprised. I thought I'd kept hostility quite cleverly disguised. I told the Lord I hate him. I told him that I hurt. I told him that he isn't fair. He's treated me like dirt. I told God I was angry, but I'm the one surprised. What I've known all along, he said, you've finally realized. At last you have admitted what's really in your heart. Dishonesty, not anger, was keeping us apart. Even when you hate me, I don't stop loving you. Before you can receive that love, you must confess what's true. In telling me the anger you genuinely feel, it loses power over you, permitting you to heal. I told God I was sorry, and he's forgiven me. The truth that I was angry had finally set me free. And that was such a big affirmation to that, the fact. And I've worked with a number of different alcoholics that did have the same problem. To kind of wrap things up.
Yeah, then we have time, just maybe one or two questions.
Yeah, I ended up not making it. I got diagnosed with Hep C. And the process was an interferon treatment for 1 year. The side effects were really something. I ended up using opioids to relieve the side effects. Long term, whatever happened, the insanity returned, and I could not get it out of my mind. And again, ended up back. I ended up on methadone, buying it off the street. And it was horrible for me because I'd had all this time, working with others, being in the church, knowing and almost watching what I was doing to myself and not being able to stop, no matter how hard I wanted to.